Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is FM Industries against Citicorp Credit Services.
Morning, Your Honor.
Mr. Lehane.
My name is Jack Lehane. I represent FMI. I'd like to begin by saying that I cannot lay the case out better than I did in the brief. There's a very complicated, detailed, and I would say angry record that's before this court on this appeal. But I think I can hit the high points here. I think that the first thing I'd like to stress, and although I want to rely on my entire brief, the first thing I want to stress is that ownership should not have been an issue in this case. There was no defendant that claimed ownership of the copyrights that are involved with this software. There was no rival claimant that was ever produced or identified or that surfaced to contend for ownership of the copyright of the software. We did not stress in the briefs the waivers that were executed by the parties, although that's of record as well, because this court has held that that's not dispositive, but there were waivers. The parties agreed in the contract documents themselves that FMI owned the copyrights. The transfer from one related entity to another related entity.
I don't understand what you're arguing here. The district court never reached this conclusion. It just said that summary judgment was not going to be granted to either party on this topic. And then in the end, it never reached it because a proper pretrial order was not prepared. So this is not an issue that's been decided, or I should think, not an issue open to us here.
Well, it is an issue, I believe, open to this court in as much as the court should have decided this issue in FMI's favor.
Yes, but it didn't. It decided the case on a different issue, and I think you'd be well advised to argue the grounds on which you lost rather than arguing a ground on which you didn't lose.
Well, let me skip to that, Your Honor. I mean, I think that's actually a fairly simple issue in as much as where by the time we reach that May 6th date where the district court dismissed this case, there had been exactly two times when a pretrial order had been requested, had been directed to be presented, one on May 2nd, and then the following week on May 6th. There was a situation in that case where, as the transcript shows, counsel told the court that he'd agreed to every change that was requested by Mr. Duffy, and had acceded to every change that was requested, and that it was just a matter of putting it all together.
I think the problem with that is that it suggests that these pretrial orders were in isolation from the rest of the case, and they of course weren't. The district court and the magistrate judge who was assisting the district court had been through quite a bit, and the pretrial orders were not, in fact, being served in a timely manner. They were, you know, people were getting things at 10:30 at night, as I remember. And so I think the overall picture is part of what the district court was entitled to take into account in following up on its warning that it might dismiss the case if a proper order wasn't timely presented.
And the overall picture in this case is one of, as I'm sure you're aware, furious motion practice on both sides, which the district court...
What gives lawyers a bad name. I mean, the amount of motion practice in this case is shocking, actually.
I would not dispute that point, Your Honor. I would say that, you know, it's a matter of trying to figure out who struck the first blow, and I don't think that that's productive. I would say, however, that in this
case... But doesn't the district judge have the discretion to do that, to make that judgment as to who the good guy, who the bad guy is when you have this sort of flurry of motions back and forth?
Yes, Your Honor, I do believe that's true. However, in this case, the district court had made prior determinations, docket 213, where the court said, look, both sides have engaged in wasteful and excessive motion practice and done very little discovery on the merits. That's pretty close to a quote. The fact of the matter is that the court was at one point upset with everybody, but the consequences landed squarely on the shoulders of my client, $800,000 worth of consequences all told. So that's a fairly significant shift in a case where the merits were never reached and all this discovery was taking place, which I believe was taking place on side issues such as ownership of the copyright. And that's where that ownership issue comes back into play, because all of this motion practice and all of this argument back and forth, the weekly sessions before Magistrate Judge Denlow, I think sometimes in October, November, there may have even been a couple of sessions where they were more than once weekly, were revolving around this spurious ownership issue that is precluded, I believe, under the ruling of this case and the Billy Bob Teeth case. It seems to me that the district court got sidetracked for whatever reason, and should never have gotten to the point where the parties were allowed to do this. It seems to me that part of the problem, and I don't presume to be an expert in court management, but it seems to me that while the district court has discretion in any case to set deadlines, as this court has held on numerous occasions, and to enforce them vigorously, if those deadlines are not realistic, or if those deadlines are being manipulated by the parties for whatever reason, the district court, I believe, has an obligation to examine the reason behind those deadlines. It seems to me that at some point you create almost an incentive to stall. We have, in this case, discovery motion. Counsel for Citibank listed a whole list of discovery motions that were filed. Among them was a motion to compel the depositions of two of the then parties, Brown and Gillard, which was granted, and the depositions were never taken. One of the things that the district court said in refusing to extend discovery on January 10, 2008, was that you've only taken one deposition. Actually, it was two, but you've only taken one deposition in the case. Shame on you. However, it's not that one-sided where you have orders that are entered, presumably with the expectation that there will be compliance, and yet there is no compliance. If you're going to sit in a situation where you say, well, the court is going to determine who the bad guy is and who isn't the bad guy, I suggest that in this case there's plenty of blame to go around, and it's not entirely one-sided. This is not the kind of case where one party alone is solely responsible for the difficulties that the district court and the magistrate judge encountered in handling this case.
But I want to go back to Judge Easterbrook's opening point. The district court winds up dismissing this case because of the failure of you and your client to put together this pretrial order. The standard of review for an action like that is abuse of discretion. There's no doubt that the district court had warned you. There's no doubt that a lot had gone on that was entirely unproductive. You have your view of who's to blame. As Judge Tinder says, it's up to the district court to make that kind of assessment. I'm not sure we're in a position to say the district court was so far out of bounds as to have abused her discretion.
As we said in our brief, the court looks to the totality of the circumstances. I believe you said that as well. And I think when you look at the totality,
when you then put the thumb on the scale for the abuse of discretion standard of review, then I think you're in a difficult position because there's a lot going on. But the more you emphasize what was going on, the more the judgment of the judicial officer who's there on hand is to be respected.
Here is where I think that there's a distinction to be drawn. In the cases that have been decided by this court on the same grounds that we're talking about here, dismissal for failure to submit a pretrial order, we generally have little activity, no activity.
Here, why is that? But excessive activity is a different kind of abuse. Those kinds of dismissals don't exist solely because of essentially failure to prosecute.
But we have in this situation, if it is excessive activity, it is excessive activity on both sides, as the district court properly
That's
recognized.
That's your characterization, and the district court made that one comment that you have alluded to. It's in the record. But on the other hand, the district judge makes a global assessment of what's going on, and decides in her discretion that that enough is enough, and she dismisses what's actually a little tail end of this case. It's just the injunctive relief, right?
That's right. And we should never have gotten to that point.
Why was that even important at that point? No one was using your software anymore.
Well, that's the contention. Of course, the contention was that they weren't using it after 2005 as well. And then when the limited discovery that we were able to conduct was conducted, we discovered that, in fact, they'd been using it right up until the end. And I'm getting into my rebuttal time, and I don't want to get too far.
Actually, that way of putting it caused some puzzlement in my mind. Copyright laws prohibit the copying of things, not the using of things. Why would the using of the software be a problem if there was no further copying?
The loading of a computer program, and that's what we're talking about here, itself is a copying. And the district court did correctly recognize that in the initial order denying summary judgment in favor of FMI, the motion for partial summary judgment. Every time that program was loaded and every time that program was used for the exact purpose that it was designed for, to collect delinquent accounts for the benefit of Citibank, was a copyright violation for the copyright holder, FMI. Your Honors, I'm going into my rebuttal time, so I'd like to conclude quickly so as to not exhaust it entirely. The point I'd like to stress in closing is that if we have a situation here where we have hundreds of thousands of dollars of sanctions that were entered against my client in terms of fees, costs, because the district court and the magistrate judge may have been exasperated with everybody and everyone's conduct in the case. It seems to me that this application of the fee rule goes against the statements of this court that the award of fees is not to be mechanical or rote. It seems to me it's exactly the opposite of what the court commands. I've laid it all out in the brief in terms of this section. This court has said we don't want to articulate standards. The standards that were put up before were not particularly helpful. However, it seems to me that when the district court says a pox on all your houses, but then lands the consequences of that determination solely on my client, we have a problem of equity and justice, which this court can correct. With that, I would reserve whatever remaining time I have for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Ryan.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Wayne Ryan. I am appearing here pro se in opposition to the awarding of 1927 sanctions against myself and attorney William McGrath. My representation in this matter was solely zealous representation of my client, which is my obligation as an attorney. It's my opinion, my humble opinion, that I did not exceed that representation. There is nothing that I have done.
Mr. Ryan, let me tell you what my problem here is. It looks to me very much like you licensed the use of your name to a non-lawyer for the purpose of conducting litigation in U.S. District Court. Right? You allowed a non-lawyer to sign your name to documents that, so far as this record reveals, you did not review before filing. Now, that not only looks sanctionable, it looks like a form of unauthorized practice of law.
Mr. Friedman was acting as my paralegal. The signing of the he is the one with the expertise in the ECM program, not myself. The work that was done, the legal work, was done by myself. The research was done by myself.
Did you review every filing before it was filed in the district court?
That is correct.
I didn't ask something to which you could say that is correct. I asked you a question.
Yes.
You say you did.
I believe that I reviewed every document that was filed. As to the discovery situation, every effort, every motion that I filed was an effort to bring about compliance with discovery. This was thwarted at every moment by my opponent. It necessitated filing of numerous motions in this case in order to bring about compliance so that we would have the necessary documentation so that we could proceed with the depositions in this matter. In hindsight, perhaps I should not have asked for $815 million, but the purpose of that motion was to draw the attention of the defendants to the severity of the situation and to establish our need to obtain this discovery. As I said, the discovery was being thwarted at every opportunity by my opponent.
But the underlying litigation itself, the $815 million in sanctions is one issue. The effort to obtain statutory damages under the copyright laws is another issue, and you seem to think that because this was pleaded in the alternative, it somehow isn't there, but it is there. Doesn't matter if it's pleaded in the alternative.
Right. It's my understanding that the copyright, there's a mistake there, was copyrighted in 2006, and that there was ongoing copyright infringement subsequent to that. I see that my light has gone off. I would like to reserve some rebuttal time.
I suggest that you answer Judge Wood's question.
It is our opinion that there was ongoing infringement. There is a three-month reach-back period, as was discovered in the deposition that we took, that even after the expiration of the licensing agreement, there was copyright infringement on the part of Mr. Ross.
And your only evidence of that, as I understand it, is this Talking Points memo that you point to?
That is correct.
Okay.
With that, I would ask to reserve any time remaining for rebuttal.
Mr. Ryan?
Thank you.
Mr. Davis?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Champ Davis, and I represent William McGrath, and Mr. McGrath is in court here. Mr. McGrath and I are with the firm of Davis and McGrath, and we've been law partners for many, many, many years. Mr. McGrath also, in addition to practicing with our firm, teaches copyright law at John Marshall Law School. We are appealing from the Section 1929 sanctions. We believe it is clear from the record facts in this case that there's no grounds for concluding that Mr. McGrath unreasonably or vexatiously multiplied the proceedings in this case.
The Let me suit ask was you filed, what you think would have happened if, after the second amended complaint, Mr. McGrath had looked at it and said, whatever infringement may have been going on was done, whether it was infringement or not, whatever use, I'll say, was finished as of 2005. This is 2006, before the registration happens. In my professional judgment, this evidence is too thin a read to proceed on, given Rule 11, given professional obligations. I can't be part of this anymore.
That those facts did not occur, according
well,
to
Mr. I know, but isn't that what he should have done?
No, I don't believe he should have done that. I believe there was still a basis for the case. There was the complaint was based on also actual damages and not just statutory damages, which the lower court seemed to rely on, and saying that Mr. McGrath multiplied the proceedings. He was brought in by Mr. Ryan to give opinions on copyright issues as requested.
But I understand that FMI's prayer for relief actually asked for $15 billion in statutory damages.
Well, I don't know that that may have been the case, but I don't know that that multiplied the proceedings in any way. And
it certainly
Mr. McGrath,
changes the stakes from Citibank's point of view, or City Services, whichever member of the family we're talking about, point of view.
Well, again, even though Section 1927 is a single sentence, it has six essential requirements, or a half a dozen requirements that have to be satisfied. The proceedings must be multiplied unreasonably and vexatiously. Excess costs must be reasonably incurred by reason of that. There's a cause and effect, and I don't think there's any showing as to, you see lawsuits all the time that say we seek millions of dollars in damages. I don't think there's any showing here that any fact on which to conclude that that multiplied the proceedings. In fact, Mr. McGrath was barely involved in these proceedings. There were over 500 docket entries, electronic docket entries in this case. Mr. McGrath filed pleadings with his name on them in five of those over 500 docket entries. That's fewer than 1% of the docket entries. And those pleadings that he was involved in related to seeking summary judgment against the Gelfand law firm. And it's significant here that while the Gelfand law firm has sought attorney's fees under the Copyright Act, they are not seeking sanctions under Section 1927. Mr. McGrath had absolutely no involvement, and it's clear from his declaration, which is in our short appendix, it's clear that he had no involvement against Citicorp. He wasn't involved in the discovery. He wasn't involved. He was in court twice, once before Judge Denlow shortly after his appearance was filed, and once before Judge Conlon, and then one time at a settlement conference. And it's very difficult to see how that could have multiplied the proceedings in any way. Judge Denlow, in his report, he cites these factors on which he concludes that Mr. McGrath multiplied the proceedings to a significant degree. He says, lack of interest in improving the case through discovery, harassment of defendants on the pretext of discovery, attempting to depose the chairman of Citicorp, and seeking sanctions over frivolous matters. And he cites two motions. One motion was in September 24, and the other was in December 31. Mr. McGrath wasn't involved in any of those matters. He did not, as he states in his declaration, he was not involved in the discovery whatsoever. I think Magistrate Denlow's report and Judge Conlon's opinion also ignore the invoices, the fee invoices. We've set them forth in our short appendix, and there are approximately 30 pages of fee invoices. They don't involve Mr. Grant at all. They involve discovery matters over which he had no control and over which he did not participate. It also ignores the fact there's some suggestion in there that the pursuit of statutory damages, which were in the first complaint, they were alleged that somehow multiplied the proceedings, and they did not. And finally, Judge Conlon's opinion was essentially. Thank you.
Mr. Dale.
May it please the Court. I'm here this morning representing three clients, Citicorp Credit Services Incorporated, Citigroup Incorporated, and Citibank South Dakota N.A. I will take up part of our 25 minutes. At the end of that, we'll hear from counsel for the law offices of Ross Gelfand. At its root, the case alleged against my clients is fairly simple. They needed to prove inducement to infringe a copyright in the Toucan software. FMI was never able to establish these facts and did not try diligently in discovery to find facts that would support this cause of action. There were basically three things that they needed to prove.
Could I just ask you, though, I mean, one of the things that Mr. Lehane stresses is that a big part of the reason discovery didn't go forward the way it should have is that your clients were throwing roadblocks up. You know, everything was a struggle, whether it was the required initial disclosures or whether it was any other kind of information that needs to be exchanged. What's your response to that?
We litigated this case like a billion-dollar case filed against our clients. Our initial disclosures were filed on time. Our opponents were filed weeks late. They filed 16 different motions to compel in this case and sought sanctions in every single one. The sanctions that they sought against us totaled over $1 billion. Not a single nickel in sanctions was ever awarded against any of my clients. They filed 23 different discovery motions over the course of this litigation. They filed the same discovery motions three and four different times. They'd file them, they were denied. They'd file them again. Because the magistrate judge is an incredibly patient man, they filed them again and again and again. But even that patience wore out by the end of the litigation. I would suggest that the district court and the magistrate judge in assisting the district court were in the perfect position to determine who the good guy was and who the bad guy was, and made that determination eloquently in the report and recommendations from the magistrate judge and in the memorandum opinion and order that approved those, that report and those recommendations. Because there were no facts to support their claims, they took a different course. FMI and its counsel, Attorney McGrath and Attorney Ryan, decided instead to make wild accusations, seek wild amounts of money in sanctions, and not attempt to prove their case. That's why we're here.
Can I ask you in terms of the evidence, since you're touching on that? I just asked, I forget, one of your opponents, whether the only evidence that these programs were used after 2005 was that one memo where, you know, something like paragraph 17 refers only to Tucknet and not to Toucans, and that's right. The only evidence of post 2005.
That's the only evidence.
Activity of some kind. Yeah.
There are two separate questions. One is whether there was any activity post 2005 that would be a direct infringement, and the second issue was whether there was any indication that my client induced that infringement, took any active steps. The document to which you refer goes to the second of those two questions. That is the only evidence that they purport to have to show that any of the city entities did anything to induce an infringement. And essentially what they say is city didn't do enough to go around to every lawyer who ever had the Toucans program, look over that lawyer's shoulder, and make sure that the lawyer was not infringing. They do not point to any direction from any of my clients to keep using the program. There has to be an active and material contribution to direct infringement in order to show contributory infringement or inducement to infringe against my client. So that's the one piece of evidence that they would have against my client, and I would suggest to the court that the inference that they try to draw from it goes far beyond viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, and in fact calls for wild speculation and conjecture. The other evidence that they have of direct infringement, and the counsel for the law offices of Ross Gelfand will certainly address this probably better than I will, is during Mr. Gelfand's deposition, there was some testimony that in order to retrieve data that was owned by my client, attorney work product information, attorney client communications, they had to go into the Toucans program. And
so,
as
so
we know,
it was my understanding, and I'm actually thinking of other cases too, that you have these programs which organized the data, you know, customer name, account number,
right. Debt,
what have you,
right.
And that somehow this program needed to be used to extract that data so that it could be ported over to whatever successor software the companies, city and the companies were using. Is that a fairly accurate picture?
Yes. What happened is they took our data that we owned and they locked it up and they kept it away from us. And they try to now claim that in an attempt to access our own data and also public domain information, that we necessarily infringe their copyright. Or I should take a step back. That the attorneys accessing that information actually infringe their copyright. It's important, I think.
Like Mr. Gelfand.
Like Mr. Gelfand. That's exactly right. Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
So the reason we're here today, talking about sanctions, talking about fees and costs, is because of the way the plaintiff and the plaintiff's counsel chose to litigate this case. So the first issue is whether or not the district court abused its discretion by refusing to extend for a third time the discovery cutoff. The question becomes, what time did FMI have to conduct discovery, and what did they do with it? As we've already discussed, what they managed to do, what they chose to do, is take all of two depositions in the course of an 8-month period. Now, earlier in the period, in the summer, 2 or 3 months after they'd filed their case, they did serve deposition notices for the chairman and chairman emeritus of the ultimate parent corporation of my clients. There is absolutely no indication that either of these men had the first clue what the Toucan software was, how it was used, and whether there was any valid copyright that had been infringed by anyone on Earth.
So, Mr. Gale, how much time could that possibly have wasted? I mean, it seems to me, although it's a silly request, it couldn't have taken you that long to...
We didn't even have to file a motion to quash that particular subpoena. You're absolutely right.
So
it's indicative.
It's sort of color, but it's not really too important.
That standing alone, I agree with you. When viewed in context of the overall fabric of the way this litigation was conducted, the 16 motions to compel seeking over $1 billion in sanctions, the one motion to compel where they sought $815 million in sanctions because they got data 24 hours late. The exact data that the district court ordered be produced, they got it 24 hours late, and that was somehow worth $815 million. It's shameful. The way this litigation was conducted, they served deposition, or excuse me, they served subpoenas on 30 different law firms around the country. Every law firm that ever used the Toucan software or allegedly used the Toucan software while trying to collect accounts for one of my clients, every one of them. They attached to those subpoenas credit card account numbers and names and addresses and account balances for all of these accounts. We had a Graham Leach Bliley obligation to make sure that that information stayed confidential and private. That took some time.
I'm sure it did. Let me turn your attention briefly to Mr. McGrath, because the things that you're complaining about, as also the things that Magistrate Judge Denlow mentioned and Judge Conlon, do appear to lie at the doorstep of Mr. Rhine, not Mr. McGrath. Talk to me about causation of what Mr. McGrath did to justify the 1927 $35,000 portion of the sanctions, and also whether we have a causation issue and a proportionality issue.
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. McGrath, as described by his counsel here this morning, as described by FMI in their briefs, and as described by FMI at the district court, is their expert on copyright law. He is a dean of the copyright bar here in Chicago. He teaches intellectual property, copyright law specifically, at the John Marshall Law School.
He's not teaching civil procedure, it sounds like.
Well, I think that's fair to say.
And the sanctions in 1927 sanction, not a Rule 11 sanction.
That's right. It's not a Rule 11 sanction. The question is what he did that was vexatious to multiply the litigation. He made an appearance in September of 2007, and 2 weeks later they filed an amended complaint. And in that amended complaint, they continued to seek statutory damages, spelled out at $7.2 billion. The fact that they sought $7.2 billion in statutory damages before Mr. McGrath became involved and continuing after his involvement certainly multiplied these proceedings. To give one specific example, we had to move separately for summary judgment just on that particular issue. We moved for summary judgment in our favor on the statutory damages point.
Is there any respect in which Mr. McGrath is responsible for multiplying anything? The theory you've just articulated seems to be after McGrath entered the case, things didn't improve. But one would think the minimum showing under 1927 would be that after McGrath entered the case, things got worse in some way,
under
the way for which he was responsible. Is there some way in which that happened?
I believe there is, Your Honor, because he did not assert himself as he should have.
No, that's a claim that he didn't improve things, that he owed you a duty to correct the errors of Mr. Rhine. That's certainly not what 1927 is about. So my question stands.
Yes, sir.
Is there an ascertainable way in which Mr. McGrath made things worse?
As I understand the standard that's applied in this court, as articulated in the Jolly Group case.
Just answer my question.
I am trying to
articulate standards.
Okay. I am trying to, and I don't mean to try your patience. Our position is that Mr. McGrath multiplied these proceedings because he did not change the course of the litigation.
So your answer to my question is no.
It's
a simple two-word answer. You may say that you don't lose because of that, but
yes, sir.
It's always nice to get the answer.
All right, then. Then my answer is no. certainly Mr. Ryan has earned and deserved the Section 1927 sanctions against him. He signed electronically all of the pleadings in this case, all of the multiple motions to compel and for sanctions. He came to court and as I think well articulated by the panel this morning, licensed his name to practice law to a non-lawyer. You can see from the transcripts before the magistrate judge that his client made many appearances and argued the case as if he were an attorney.
Based the client on, was actually Mr. Friedman was arguing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Those are in transcripts before the magistrate judge. I don't have those record sites before me now, but I could certainly supply them to the court.
This was not the settlement conference.
This was not the settlement conference. No, sir. These were early appearances before the magistrate judge when we were there most every Monday morning and most every Wednesday morning on another motion to compel him for sanctions.
And Mr. Ryan was with him? And was any sentence like, I'd like to ask Mr. Friedman to explain this or anything?
Absolutely. Okay. Yes, Your Honor. Repeatedly. I choosing not to conduct any real discovery, instead zealously pursuing massive sanctions. Again, the example of the depositions that they chose to take as opposed to depositions they chose not to take. All of these things make very clear that the 1927 damages were far from an abuse of discretion, were in fact a just dessert.
Could I nail down one small detail about the subpoenas that you were talking about a minute ago?
Yes, Your Honor.
I thought I remembered from your brief that these were subpoenas that were issued actually beyond the jurisdiction of the court.
28 of the 30 subpoenas were. Two of them were for lawyers right here in Chicago. And so what the magistrate judge suggested, ordered in fact, in September of 2007, is that FMI go ahead and take the depositions of those two law firms.
Properly served.
Exactly, exactly. They never did.
But they did, and they didn't ever go to the appropriate court to get a discovery subpoena.
For any of the others, right, exactly. So two of the 30, were properly served, and for those, the magistrate judge made clear that they should go forward and take those depositions and get documents from those law firms. But I thought it particularly telling that they did not choose to do that, that it was ordered in September, and we come around in January, and they never took those depositions. It did not happen.
Thank you.
I see that my time is running short because I want to leave enough time for my counsel for the law offices of Ross Gelfand. I am told that appearances by Mr. Friedman on the record before the magistrate judge were in transcripts from hearings dated July 23rd, August 8th, and July 29th. The one point I would like to make with regard to the summary judgment that was awarded on behalf of my clients, in addition to the fact that absolutely no facts were established to show material contribution by my client to any infringement, assuming an infringement occurred, or to show any knowledge on behalf of any of my clients that any infringement occurred. When we file our summary judgment motion, they did not file an opposition to our Rule 56.1 statement of undisputed facts. On page 47 of FMI's brief, they concede that the court was permitted to disregard their opposition. On that alone, we were entitled to summary judgment. At the end of the day, FMI and Attorney Ryan and Attorney McGrath asked whether discretion was abused by extending discovery only twice and by awarding fees and costs and sanctions that are squarely within the case law. They ask if summary judgment determinations were proper in the void of facts that they themselves created. In fact, it was entirely just that the consequences of their actions landed where they did. If there are no more questions, I'll now yield the podium.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Gale.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Duffy.
Good morning. I'm John Duffy, counsel on behalf of the law offices of Ross Gelfand. I think perhaps after listening to the arguments here for a little bit, it's very important for me to emphasize one very, very key fact that has been waived, one argument that's been waived in this case. FMI proceeded in the trial court on a theory of statutory damages and fees that they hung like a sword of Damocles over a Gelfand's head. Gelfand is a solo practitioner who practices outside Atlanta. The complaint sought $9.3 million from Ross Gelfand. Now, during the proceedings in this case, that was constantly put in our face. And the dramatic waiver of that very important argument on appeal should not be lost upon the panel. They don't even contest it. The very claim for which they were seeking hundreds of billions of dollars of damages against City Force.
Hundreds of billions? I hadn't heard anything over $8 billion so far. How do we get to hundreds of billions?
Perhaps I'm missing my millions.
Just completely exaggeration prone here.
No, I think with all due respect, perhaps I'm mixing my millions with my billions, so I misspoke. I apologize. But that waiver
sure
is...
You are in the Everett McKinley Dirksen United States Courthouse. Remember his famous line, a billion here, a billion there, sooner or later it adds up to real money.
True. But obviously the waiver in this case is important to point out because it was the central issue that we litigated in the trial court. Now, one of the claims that they have asked for reversal on is what was the remaining portion of this case, which was one seeking an injunction against my client. I think it's very important, obviously, to look at the standard of review here, which is abuse of discretion. The district court had listened to, if you listen to Mr. Gale's argument, presided over what was a very contentious discovery dispute between these two companies. And I think
it's
important also to
point out. Well, and that's the part, again, getting all the way back to the beginning of this argument, where the district court never does decide any of the underlying facts on the injunction, because the district court is, one can infer from the printed page, fed up with this whole thing and just says, look, you know, the lawyers are out there talking about whether one last effort at the final pretrial order is going to work, and she just goes on the record and says, it's obviously not going to work, dismissed with prejudice, right? So she's done with it at that point.
I think that's an accurate.
That's what it looks like, anyway.
That's an accurate recitation of the facts. But after hearing and reviewing the record, as I know the panel has, you can see the discretion that she exercised was certainly not an abuse. Let me take you back to one of the most important things in the pretrial order that was left on this very, very, very small portion of this case was the issue of exhibits, just exhibits for the trial. As the court knows, under Local Rule 16.1, Schedule C, Paragraph 5, if my opponent hands me a pretrial order, and in there are a bunch of exhibits, many of which I never even saw in discovery, and they submit it to me without an opportunity for me to object, they're admitted.
Well, the problem was there was just this generic description of the exhibits instead of
that was
exhibit
one of,
by exhibit?
That was the first problem. April 1 of 2008, Mr. Friedman emailed to me at about 9:15 at night the pretrial order. He was ordered to do so by Judge Conlon. That was the first attempt to try and get the exhibit issue right. And you are absolutely correct. What did they send to me? All the documents, Plaintiff's Exhibit 1, all the documents related to the vendor service agreement. Well, my goodness, that could be hundreds. I asked them to break it out. I also asked them to give me an opportunity so that I can object, because many of the things that they then gave me were documents I'd never seen before. And I'm about to ready to go into trial. I then take upon myself to redraft the pretrial order, and on April 4, I sent it back to Mr. Ryan. Then I asked them to come in for a personal meeting at my office on April 23, and there at that time appeared Mr. Ryan, Mr. McGrath, and Mr. Friedman. And I put on the table the pretrial order I had redrafted, and I said, well, what do you guys want to change about it? What should we add to it? And they said, it's fine. It's fine. And then they proceeded to try and discuss settlement with me. Then we go about 8-9 days later, May 2, we're in court, and I'm thinking what they're going to present is the document I substantially revised. And as I'm waiting, I believe the case is called at about 9 o'clock, and about 10:20, someone from Mr. Ryan's office, I think it was Mr. Friedman, came in with this draft pretrial order. Well, this is about 80 minutes after the case is called. They hand it to me in open court. I'm staring there at the podium, and I have to go through this thing. I can tell almost immediately it's certainly not the document that I redrafted. And now I'm supposed to comment on it there at the podium. Judge Conlon looks at it, and one of the first things that she noticed was that it said draft. The actual document said draft. And she said, I can't accept this. And Mr. Duffy, I'm sure you have other objections, but I'm not even going to hear you. I'm not going to accept it. And then she does the most important thing in the entire proceeding. She gives them a fair warning. Counsel for FMI, if you don't change this thing and make it acceptable and work with Mr. Duffy so that you can get the thing ready and have our trial, I will dismiss the case with prejudice. Very direct.
That's May 2, you're saying.
May 2, correct. Now they have 4 more days in which to correct the pretrial order, and I conferred with Mr. Ryan after that hearing, and I indicated to him, here are the things we got to do. One of the things that surprised me about all this, why not just take my draft? Why not send that back to me with modest changes, and then we can go forward? We come in on May 6, and the case is called, and Mr. Ryan is not there. I approach the podium, and as you'll see in the transcript, Judge Conlon asks me various questions about where it is, and I tell her I don't have it. And she says, why? And I said, I don't know. They're not here. I haven't seen it. Next thing I know, Mr. Ryan shows up in court with another version of it. And once again, this is the three strikes I'd like to point out. April 1, Mr. Friedman sends me one without my ability to object to the exhibits. The May 2 version has nowhere for me to object to their exhibits. Now we show up on May 6, still nowhere for me to object to their exhibits. And there are literally thousands of pages I've never seen before. And they're going to be presumptively admissible. Judge Conlon at that point, and you're right, I think it probably shows that there's some frustration coming off the page. She says, go out and confer with Mr. Duffy and let's find out what we really have here. So we go out in the hallway for 15 or 20 minutes and I'm looking at the pretrial order and I'm trying to take copious notes because I'm doing it here on the fly. I'm trying to figure out what they didn't do that I asked them to do and what it is that I can come in and explain to the district court judge. We come back in, and obviously she'd already dismissed the case. But given this record, I don't think that it was undue, and I certainly don't think it was an abuse of her discretion. Her patience was tried repeatedly. And to give them 3 opportunities, April 1, May 2, and May 6, is sufficient. And the thing that even then makes it more difficult to understand from our perspective when they come and appeal this ruling is the very fact that they file a motion to reconsider. And in there, they don't even attach the pretrial order itself in a corrected form. How can they see?
Not to mention the Rule 60B motions.
That's correct. Yeah. And it's not there. And so I can see, obviously, that my time is running short. One of the things I'd like to point out that was pointed out by counsel for FMI is that the pretrial order was only presented twice. No, it was presented 3 times. 3 times. One of the other things, he has lumped the law offices of Ross Gelfand into the discovery disputes, and I wanted to point out that from my memory, I think we filed 1 discovery motion on behalf of Mr. Gelfand and his firm. We presented 2 witnesses for deposition on short notice. I think we got the notices the week between Christmas
and
New
Year's.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Lehane?
Yes, I may, Your Honor. Mr. Gale says that FMI did not try to obtain the discovery and then proceeds to tell you about 16 or 23, he uses different numbers, attempts. Many of them unsuccessful, some spectacularly unsuccessful, to compel discovery, to obtain discovery. The record shows that there were documents that were produced, 5,000 pages of documents produced in late November, mere weeks before the expiration of the last and final discovery period. The last pleadings motion wasn't disposed of until late December, less than 3 weeks before the expiration of the last and final discovery period. Counsel says it's shameful the way the case was conducted. I agree that it was shameful that Brown and Gillard are ordered to be deposed and they're not produced. I think it's shameful that thousands of pages of documents are produced at the 11th hour and then all the consequences are heaped upon my client. He talks about the Rule 56.1 statement, which we do cover in the brief. And the fact of the matter is that on the summary judgment motions, there were 3 of them filed by the CCSI city defendants, there was one 56.1 statement that was not filed. It was, and the court does have the discretion not to consider anything that was improperly before it, and that's correct. But, Judge Wood, you brought up the talking points memo, and I will grant you that that is not the greatest piece of smoking gun evidence ever discovered. However, in that memo, it was tied to an affidavit filed by Jeanette Brown, which said, we don't want you to use this program anymore because it's unreliable. The affidavit says, we don't want you to use 2 cans which is the actual collection program in the office, or TUCnet, which is the pipeline that takes the information between the attorney's office and Citicorp and goes through FMI. The fact of the matter is that TUCans and TUCnet were not specified in the talking points memo. Indeed, in the talking points memo, it says, we don't care what program you use. Just don't tell FMI what you're using and stop using the TUCnet. And they said, this program is unreliable. That's one of the reasons why we want to stop using it. It was so unreliable that they wanted to stop using it in 2003, and they're still using it in 2005 when this talking points memo goes out. Granted, not a lot, but it's something, and it's more than they had to oppose, if you will. The Gelfand defendants had to oppose the summary judgment against them, where all they had was their suspicions about who owned the copyrights. Quickly, there was, with regard to the disposition of the case before Judge Conlon, I stand on the record that there were only two occasions on which a pretrial. Thank you, Ron.
Anything further, Mr. Ryan?
Yes, please. Yes, I would just like to emphasize, as Mr. Lehane has done so, that there were numerous motions presented. The sole reason those motions were presented dealing with discovery was to make sure that the defendants in this case, particularly the CCSI defendants, complied with the necessary discovery that was needed so that we may move forward with the case. Without that, those documents to take these depositions would be a meaningless task. As to the Todd Gale's statements about Mr. Friedman only spoke to the court with the court's permission, and as my recollection, only spoke concerning technical matters. He is the founder of the TUCAN system. He knows the expertise, something that neither Judge Denlow nor myself knew, and it was with the permission of Judge Denlow that he addressed the court and answered specific questions concerning the operations of the TUCAN system. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, judges.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.